Yeah, does it feel like everything you practically touch these days requires a new password? What strategy, I wonder, have you taken to try and keep them all at hand? Do you write them somewhere in the back of a book? Some people I know keep Word documents on file that are invisible. They've actually unbolded, they turned all the letters into white, and that's how they remember them and try and keep them secure. Do you replace letters with numbers in Word so that you won't forget? Do you cycle through the days of the week when you're trying to set a password? How do you do it? Do you have one password for everything? That's an absolute no-no. Would it be possible to live in a world without passwords altogether? In fact, there are all sorts of new and interesting emerging ways to verify your identity that wouldn't require a password. Some are more weird and wonderful than others. Let's find out more. Dr. Katina Michael is Associate Professor in the School of Information Systems and Technology at the University of Wollongong. She's Associate Dean there of International in the Faculty of Engineering and Information Sciences. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
There was a time before passwords.
There was.
Take us back there.
We used to look into each other's eyes and say, I know who you are by face. And it was a form of facial recognition, and it was manual. Mm. And we also used to use nicknames, like, not original names to know who people were, but we would look into each other's faces and be able to identify each other. But we also used other techniques. Slaves, for example, in ancient times were branded or tattooed. And even some forms of acceptable tattooing in the Polynesians, for example, created a group membership of sorts.
Yeah, that's a whole other era, isn't it?
It is.
And that sort of oral tradition of identifying yourself.
Yes, to
has
the village
been lost.
Elder. Yes, I mean, we all used to know each other in small communal areas because we would live in villages and not highly urbanised cities. This was, of course, pre the Industrial Revolution. So in a village of 500 people, there was an elder who was like the person you'd go to, or there was a church that would hold marriage records and birth certificates. And this has all been lost with dense urban areas and factories and people coming together. And when people come together, of course, there's a higher incidence of crime and of dispute.
Mm. So the Industrial Revolution is one shift. The internet, obviously, is the other. We're living so much of our lives online as solo entities, and that we have to verify our identity in that space digitally somehow.
Every single time we touch an application, and a lot of the manual tasks that we used to take for granted, like going to the bank teller to withdraw money, have all now been automated, and so many bank branches have closed. So the more applications and touch points we have, the more passwords we have to remember. And as you said at the beginning, the biggest no-no is to use the same password or to cycle through different passwords for different applications or to connect those applications together. So your Facebook becomes your default password for everything else, or your Google Plus account becomes your default password for everything else.
And the risks are very real, aren't they? Identity theft is a terrifying prospect. Some people's lives are just totally undermined by identity theft.
Yes, and it's very asymmetric. If it hasn't happened to you, you pretty much think all of this is either some form of conspiracy theory or exaggerated. But when identity theft or fraud happens to you, the implications are great. There are some people, for example, in the United States who have had their social security number taken and can't prove their own identity, for instance.
Yeah, that gives me nightmares.
Yes.
That prospect. That's like some sort of horrible Blade Runner dystopian scenario, isn't it? That you are flesh and blood in the world, but your selfhood has been stolen from you in some way.
That's right. When we read about these big hacks that are occurring in the 100 millions range of subscribers and customers, you think, wow, one hacker took only 11 hours or an hour and a half to crack, a system, and was able to divulge, 100 million, for example, was one of the biggest hacks that we've seen, subscriber passwords. And what did we discover? Even from the most recent Ashley Madison hack, was that people use the passwords 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They use the password 6, 7, 8, 9. Another one is they use the word password for the password, or default as the password.
Or their name.
Or their name, so something very simple.
Mm. Or their birthday. Or their dog's
yes.
name. Or the dog's
yes.
name's probably easier, unless it's Spot, 1, 2, 3, 4. So what we wanted to talk about with you was this whole new frontier which might allow us to function in the world without passwords. Let's introduce people to what's emerging, what the interesting alternatives are.
So traditionally there have been like three forms of authentication. How do you prove who you are? And one is knowledge, that's the passwords we've been talking about. The other one is I possess something like a token. And tokens have three forms, basically. I can lug them around like a smart card, or a contactless card that we use, for example, for our pay-and-go payment at the supermarket.
Mm.
Another type of token that we're looking at in terms of emerging services are wearable devices that are a bit like the card, but they're attached to your body through an Apple Watch, for instance. And the third one is one that sits on the skin like a nano tattoo or an implantable subdermal device that can be used as a contactless payment scheme. So instead of carrying a purse, you basically go through a supermarket area and just walk out with your goods after scanning them.
See, now see what you just did then? You went from an object in our hand to an implantable device that identifies us. That's almost a leap too far for some people, isn't it? That's kind of the cyborgian dream realised. Sounds interesting to me, though.
Well, Google, 2 years ago, with Motorola X, had put through and forward the proposal of having a swallowable pill, a security pill that I take every day in the morning. The security password changes each day as I swallow that pill. And they were really thinking about this as a possibility 2 years ago, and they're still investigating it. Like, there are different companies that are looking at electronic tattoos, for example, or payment schemes on watches, but it's not as far-fetched as people might think. Half of the Brits expect to replace cash with new technologies in a Lloyd Bank survey, and 7% of people said they'd think about embedded microchips as payment schemes, and a third said they'd do wearable technologies, pay-as-you-go. But I would say these emerging technologies are not only dystopian, but quite risky.
Well, let's get to that, but there's another element here, and that's biometrics. And that is using our unique physical and behavioural characteristics of our own individual body
yes.
to identify ourselves.
And that was the third form of authentication, yes.
So just explain some of the developments there. There's been some really interesting efforts around this. And India is undertaking a remarkable experiment here, I gather.
They are. And the first thing to note is that over, you know, it was the 1870s when actually somebody, a magistrate in India, an English magistrate, actually used fingerprints because the person couldn't sign. So they took the person's fingerprint as an identity and a land title deeds record instead of a seal. It was a fingerprint.
Mm.
And so India now, and biometrics, just for our community and listeners,
yeah.
are things like fingerprints, iris, hand recognition, facial, retina, DNA, and they're automated techniques now. So they've been around for a long time, but now they're automated. Computing has allowed them to occur in a fast manner.
And it's more than fingerprints and irises in your eye and facial recognition. It's things like the gait of your walk,
yes.
or your personal stench, your scent or your odour. It's your voice, your
yes.
speech.
And these are traits, and even our writing style. And something that Google came out with 2 years ago is they said, look, biometrics are too personal. They shouldn't be used for two-factor authentication. What we should be using, rather, are things like sensor-based data, like where you log in, how often you log in, how often you pick up your phone to call somebody. Your social network should be a social and behavioural insight way of doing authentication with a password.
That's assuming, though, that people's behavioural patterns are consistent, and that's not necessarily the case.
No, but we are creatures of habit, and these companies, down to a T, have recognised that behavioural traits, not just our voice and writing speed and gait, but our behaviours are actually quite repetitive week in, week out. How often we get an alert from Facebook, how often we'll dive into our handbag to pick up an application and to look at it, or send an Instagram, are actually very, very determinable things. They're predictable.
So what's happening in India? And is it working? They're doing this at a population scale.
It's huge. I mean, the biggest biometric rollout we've had previously in the US has been 50 million people. And these are isolated state-based social security schemes, which take facial or fingerprint images. But in a country that has 1.2 billion people, 83% of the population in the last 5 years has enrolled into the ADAR system. And a lot of advocates in the privacy space and actually even the technology space are arguing, how can we prove that biometrics on that scale are unique? We know they're unique within a smaller scale like 50 million prints, but we don't know at a global like 1.2 billion scale. Is it working? It's a little bit scary. There's no legislation to support a mandatory adoption of this, but the way it's been instigated is being linked to a bank account number. So basically, you enroll in the system. It's not mandatory, but you're told if you don't, you may not be able to use certain services. Employee IDs are now being linked to ADAR. And we have this scope creep. So it was initially introduced as a unique identity scheme, but it has now been used for bank accounts.
But it's got some problems because in India, hard-working citizens have had their fingerprints worn away through manual labour. On the other hand, millions of Indian people have malnourishment-induced cataracts, so it means their irises aren't easily identifiable using this sort of kind of snapshot that's taken at some point of your biology.
Yes, and they're called the untouchables. Unfortunately, there's a large segment of population base that won't be able to enrol one mode. So in the ADAR system, they're taking iris, fingerprint and facial recognition. And if you don't have fingerprints, either because you don't have fingers or the fingerprint has worn away, as you just mentioned, then another iris recognition or facial recognition will be taken. But the issue is, with the multimodal biometrics, we're giving away a lot of data and there's nothing to prove that this will reduce terrorism, fraud, or drug mafias, for example, participating in money laundering schemes and so forth.
So they're not foolproof, these techniques, and there are risks. If they were to be used at the sort of scale that India's using them, how should they be used?
Well, I think as a human rights option, they should be voluntary. And a lot of people at government level in India have said, yes, of course, the ADAR scheme is voluntary. And then in the next statement have gone to contradict their original statement. And so, but they're saying there's no legislation to say that any state-based government within India won't say that it's a mandatory thing. So the first thing, it's a human rights issue. Informed consent, I don't think people realise what they're actually giving away. Given that they're feeling like they have to enrol and register.
Are they giving anything away, though? It's just an identifiable trait.
I think I'd take Google's advice and say, if you give away something that is a personal physical characteristic that can never be changed, you know, I can change my credit card once some fraud has occurred on it. I can't change the colour of my eyes or the patterns in my eyes or my fingerprints.
But isn't that a good thing? Wouldn't that make your data more secure?
Not when the hackers will access it and then use that to replicate prints elsewhere. And basically think about it. You can dupe these systems. There's false acceptance rates, there's false rejection rates. And we've all been in that scenario where we've turned up to the airport, the international border control, and not had our e-passport verify our own face. So these things are not foolproof and we have to look at the risks associated with them. They don't work, basically.
So biometrics aren't the solution. Just very briefly and finally, then, if passwords are here to stay for the time being, what are the absolute do's and don'ts? Just briefly.
Okay, don't reuse the same passwords and don't use a dictionary word as your password and don't use standard number substitutions. They don't always work. And don't use a short password. Use the length that they're suggested. Do enable two-factor authentication. Give bogus answers to security questions because you don't want bogus people basically guessing your security answers, and scrub your online presence and make sure you use a unique secure email to send all your passwords to.
Okay, well, there's some stuff there. I'll pursue you a little further because I'd like to put some of that on our Facebook page. Katina Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for your time.